I mean,
the House Committee on Revenue will come to order.
Are you meeting?
Senate Finance and Revenue Committee will come to order.
Thank you very much for all being here this morning. This morning, our only agenda item is to receive the report of the Office of Economic Analysis. And with that, Tom, why don't we go ahead?
Good morning, Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, members of the House Revenue Committee and the House Finance and Revenue Committee, and also co-chairs of the Ways and Means Committee. For the record, my name is Tom Pitowski, a state economist with the Office of Economic Analysis in the Department of Administrative Services. With me today on my left is Joe Courtwright, who is chair of the Governor's Council of Economic Advisors and the principal at Impreza Incorporated. And then to my right is Josh Harwood, our senior economic analyst with the Office of Economic Analysis. And so for today, what we're, of course, releasing is our May 2009 forecast. In front of you, you should have a copy of today's slides that we'll be going over, also what we call our press packet, which is a forecast summary, and I believe LRO has their forecast summary in front of you. Now, I'm going to be relatively brief on my comments today because I think we want to just set the stage as to what the economic background is, and then I'll be turning it over to Josh Harwood. But first, I'd like to have Joe Courtwright present some comments.
Thank you, Tom. Chairs, members of the committees, for the record, Joe Courtwright. I am an economist with Impreza in Portland, Oregon, and chair, as Tom said, of the Governor's Council of Economic Advisors. And I'd just like to briefly spend a second reviewing what the role of the Governor's Council is. We're a group of private sector economists from various industries in various regions of the state, and we meet with Tom and his staff on a regular basis to provide input to them into the economic portion of the forecast to provide insights from our practice, from our personal observations, and to offer commentaries and suggestions to Tom on ways in which the forecast can be adapted, adjusted, and otherwise made to accurately reflect the state of the economy. And so we have a good diverse group of folks who I think can balance the statistical portrait that we get from the data with what we actually see happening in the field. And I would just say briefly, and Tom will get into the details of the forecast, we have reviewed it in some detail and I think are comfortable with the broad underpinnings of the forecast. The thing I would say, and I would counsel to you in this particular time, is we're in a period of great uncertainty. In fact, the uncertainties that attach to this forecast are probably greater than any economic forecast or any forecast period that we've had to deal with in several decades. So as you look at the forecast and as you think about its implications, the key thing for you, I think, you to think about, for you as policymakers to think about, is it is a reasonable forecast, but there is a very large band of uncertainty about what the actual outcomes will be. And I'd be happy to, in the course of discussion, give you more insight or more of the council's view on that particular question. Thanks.
Okay, and Joe will be here to answer questions if you have any as we go along. Just starting with the slides here, this is the regular slide we start off with, just showing the schematic of how we go through it. And let me just say that that's in front of you for your usage. And let's go on to the next slide. Really, I want to talk a little bit about the U.S. economy very briefly. Oregon does follow the U.S. economy. Sometimes we're not quite in step with the U.S. economy, but definitely we're following the same music. The Oregon economy may fall deeper into recession than the U.S. Sometimes it doesn't fall as deep. Sometimes it falls earlier or later, and the same thing coming out in recovery. But definitely the relationship is there. What happens in the U.S. economy affects us right here at home. And so a couple of points here. You know, the recession is the deepest and longest for the U.S. Since the 1930s. This is not just a U.S. recession. It's definitely global in scope. In fact, the belief is that this year will be the first time global economies as a group will have negative growth, the first time since the 1930s. And as you know, consumers, businesses, local governments, state governments, really the ability in the dealing with the financial market's been very difficult. Now, we have two things going in our favor. This time around in this recession, we're not having to fight inflation. That's at a relatively low level right now. Although there are worries going forward, maybe 2 years from now, it could rear its ugly head again, but at the moment, that's not a fight that we have to have. And then also the federal stimulus packages, both from the federal government, from the, our Treasury Department, our Federal Reserve System. These are just starting to really take traction, and those should also be a help for us. And then also on the energy front, although recently we've seen some energy prices going up a little bit, they are much more subdued than we saw this past summer. So next slide. Now, as economists, we have to look forward. We don't believe this is a situation where it's doom and gloom and that's how we're going to live out the rest of our lives. This recession is going to come to an end. And we have to look for, as both Ben Bernanke and President Obama said, green shoots and glimmers of hope that are out there. Now, this is just a list of a number of items that are actually economists are looking at that are saying, hey, I'm starting to see some aspect of this thing could be coming to a bottom. Now, saying that, this first item, retail sales, things look good in January and February, but then March and then just yesterday, April retail sales came out and they were down a little bit. But this is symptomatic of when you start to have turning points. You start to get good information and also some weak information. But it's not all weak. And then also the bottom one, the 4-week moving average initial claims of unemployment benefits. They seem to have peaked. But all of a sudden, the latest week, we now see it just bumping up a little bit again. Still, the trend has been for it coming down, and we don't necessarily want to say that one data point now, once again, means a trend that's going to continue. So I really think there are some signs out there that this thing is coming to an end. But as Joe mentioned, there are still great risks out there going forward. Next. And risks to the forecast, we have a couple things out there that we're unsure of how exactly they're going to hit. There appears to be another wave of foreclosures that are going to be coming. To what extent is that going to possibly dampen this sort of possible coming recovery? There's a lot of questions about the strength of the stimulus package and exactly how what timing is going to happen as to when they actually get good traction and start to help us out. In my mind, the biggest risk out there right now is our financial system. And what we have to see is some signs of that coming back to normalcy before I think we'll really see this recovery get on better footing. Next. This shows global insights, different views. Notice it's the baseline is recession, the optimistic viewpoint is recession, and the pessimistic is a deeper recession. But going forward, notice that, and I'd say the consensus of economists are there, yes, is there a recovery is happening. The tough part always is the timing of when we're going to see this. But I really believe the consensus out there is not so much of a Japan lost decade L-shaped recession, but that we will come out of this. Yes. Okay, bottom line, definitely the U.S. is in recession. The unemployment rate is expected to top 10% by the end of 2009. In some contexts, the highest unemployment rate for the U.S. during the 80s recession, early 80s, was 10.8%. So we're already right now at 8.9%, and it does tend to be a lagging indicator. So even though we may see signs of things turning around in the second half of this year, a mild turnaround, we probably will still see some job losses on the U.S. economy, still that unemployment rate rising up. And I think of all these items here, the middle bullet point, the economic recovery will begin in the fall, but growth will remain below potential through the first half of 2010. once you're on the bottom, even though you're starting to come off the bottom, it's still not a pleasant place to be. And there still is pain and sorrow, in essence, until you start to get into 2010. And then the last one, as Joe was mentioning, Governor's Council of Economic Advisors, they tend to be in general agreement with Global Insight's view of the U.S. economy, but believe that the risks are a little greater than what Global Insight believes they are, and both the upside and the downside. And as Joe mentioned, this is a really difficult time for economists in that we're sort of in these uncharted waters of rescue packages that have never been tried before and a financial collapse to the degree that we've only seen really in the Great Depression. So I don't know if, Joe, you wanted to mention the governor's council view on this.
Yeah, and I think you hit on the key point, Tom, which is, you know, economists build models of how the economy operates based on historical experience. And the kind of events that we've experienced in the last year are not ones for which we have data for the United States. The kind of financial collapse that we've seen and the fact that monetary policy now is essentially used up all of its bullets. The effective interest rate is approaching zero, which is the lower bound, means that the Federal Reserve can't simply lower interest rates further and revive the economy the way it has in virtually every other recovery since the 1930s. So we are in what economists would call an out-of-sample period. We don't have historical data that tell us how the U.S. economy will perform in a recovery in the next few years. The other thing I would add is we economists use the term recovery a lot, and that implies, I think, to a lot of people that the kind of economy that we'll get back will be recover the same jobs and businesses that we lost. And I think there's ample evidence to suggest the economy that we get going forward will be actually different in fundamental ways. And if you think about what's going on, for example, in the automobile industry, it's clear the automobile industry will not come back and look the same way. But you can think across the economy to other industries. Construction is one of them, where they will not play the same role in the next decade or so that they played in the last decade. So that's those reasons, the fact that we don't have a historical basis for this sequence of events, at least not since the 1930s, and the fact that the recovery won't be simply the process of getting back exactly what we lost, means that there's a huge amount of uncertainty about the exact path that the Oregon economy follows. And again, that's not purely pessimistic. It's uncertainty in the sense that the economy could take longer to recover than our forecast says. It also is the possibility that this fiscal medicine, which is very substantial, will at some point kick in a big way, and we may recover even faster than the models call for. But again, the key thing to keep in mind is the level of uncertainty around the forecast.
Yes, and I might add to that, economists aren't completely blind as to what course to follow. We've learned from the Great Depression things not to do. It's just that we're trying things that we haven't tried before. That's the view of the U.S. economy, and that does lead in, as I said, Oregon does follow the U.S. economy, leads into our Oregon outlook. We're at right now a 12.1% unemployment rate for March 2009. On Monday, the Oregon Employment Department releases the April numbers, and our best guess is that the unemployment rate will be higher than 12.1%. We now are matching the highest unemployment rate that we experienced during the early 80s recession, which was in November of 82. We've had job losses for five straight quarters, starting with the first quarter of 2008. And our guess is the unemployment rate most likely will top out around when the U.S. does, probably in the first quarter of 2010, and very easily be in the 13% range, could very well be in the 14% range before all is said and done. 47th fastest job growth, that's our nice way of saying the Oregon has the third slowest job growth of all the states. Our non-farm employment has dropped quite significantly. Personal income also has slowed down dramatically from where it was. And then also our exports That's a 31.9% drop in the first quarter. And that really hit our manufacturing sector. As you can see, all of 2008 finished up 17% up. So it was the fourth quarter that exports started to fall off a cliff, and they've continued to do so in the first quarter. And that really hit us very hard, especially in the manufacturing area. Okay, next. I wanted to quick show this because a lot of people have asked us. The unemployment rate's going up tremendously fast. I mean, it was just 5.5% in July of last year, and now it is more than double than that. And what I want to point out here is at the end of, we have, well, let's see if I can point with the pointer here. The two top lines are Oregon, and the two bottom lines are for the U.S. And the dark green is the labor force, and the lighter sort of green is employment. And you can see right here, we've had employment falling quite rapidly, but at the same time, we've actually had a surge in the growth of the labor force. So, and this growth of the labor force is faster than our population growth. So we're having some situation here of people, I would think this is a sign of distress in households, that, you know, everybody in the household, you know, as I said in the papers, even the 20-year-old that lives in the basement and watches TV, they're even having him go out and look for work.
Yeah? Thank God.
Yeah. And so we having this gap is grown so quickly, and the employment rate just has also gone up very quickly. Now, we expect the same sort of thing to start to happen as happened in the 2001-2002 recession. You can see that the labor force started to flatten out, both because population growth slowed down. We're seeing evidence right now of population growth slowing down in Oregon, and that the in-migration has slowed down quite a bit. And also more of the discouraged worker effect happens, where people start leaving the labor force because they haven't found work. So our expectation is this sort of rapid, huge rises we had in the unemployment rate should start to abate. We'll still see it go up, as I said, 13%, very easy, 14% range. But not jumping by a full, almost a percent and a half in 1 month that we have been seeing. This gives some aspect of the degree historically that the recession is. You can see the 2008, we don't have question marks there. We're not quite sure exactly when it will end. But given our numbers that we have, we're looking at about a 7.29% drop in jobs from the peak. Now, if you look back to the 1980-82 recession, we had a drop of about 11.5%. So even though this is the worst recession in terms of the U.S. economy, we're still just below that recession we had in the beginning of the 1980s in terms of the impact on Oregon, in terms of employment. Notice the peak to trough, this is all by employment. Our employment peaked in December 2007. We expect to regain that peak again 23 quarters later, or essentially taking about 6 years. So that means from December of 2007, sometime in the beginning of 2013, we expect to regain that. So that's a long dry spell, and this recession deep and really being dragged out. Next. Our leading indicators, this is a model that we develop in our office. It is similar to Professor Tim Dewey, University of Oregon's index. There's another index that we look at, which is the Philadelphia Federal Reserve Bank. All those are pointing, along with ours, is about the same story, in that things have been bad. No great indication of any sort of leading indicator for a turnaround yet. You can see a little bump up there at the end of March for the green line on our indicator, but still we're thinking, you know, it's 6 months off yet till we start to really see possibly recovery happening. Yes. Just a quick view. I'm taking actually a little too much time than I wanted to. How our view has changed in our forecast. The March forecast had hardly any drop at all, almost flat. As you recall, you had a special session. You wanted the forecast the first week of February. We didn't even have January's employment numbers in that March 08 forecast. And then the first half of 2008 wasn't too bad in terms of the downturn. But then things really hit in the second half, especially the fourth quarter. Likewise, we reacted to that, and our forecast dropped quite dramatically, especially the March Now we've dropped again, not by the same degree, but we feel that, yes, it's gotten a little bit worse than what our forecast is, but I think we're getting a little closer to what the actual picture is out there. Next. This is our outlook compared to 2001, 2002, 2003. You can see the deeper drop coming back up, the bounce back. Really, 2010 is still a down year overall, though we expect some mild positive growth in the second half of 2010. Really not till 2011 till you start to see a little better growth approaching the 2% range. And this is just a comparison of our past forecasts. And once again, it was, you know, how quickly things happened in the fourth quarter of 2008. And that's reflected finally, I think, in our March 08 forecast. But then also, you know, the depth, as you can see, is much more severe than what we had in 2001, 2002. That's our sort of view of the U.S. economy, the Oregon economy. Those views have an influence then on our revenue outlook that Josh Harwood is going to present to you. And if you don't mind, committee members, let's go to the revenue right away, and then we can do questions afterwards.
Thank you. Let's do that.
Thank you, chairs, members of both committees. My name is Josh Harwood, with senior economist with the Office of Economic Analysis. As has become custom, we'll start with the bottom line and then walk you through some of the components, some trends we're seeing, revisit a couple of issues that we've talked about before. 2007-09, we're looking at an ending balance right now of about negative $351 million. Final payments, which as we talked about in March, in the March forecast, are really the critical component to this, and they were worse than even our worst ever prediction, would be the way that I would put it. Final payments decreased, and we've seen this with other states around the country that we've talked to. Final payments decreased 47%. To give you some context about that, the worst period during the last recession went down about 33 or 34%. So we're seeing just dramatic drop-offs. Corporate income taxes for the first quarter of this year were off 70% year over year. As this feeds through in 2009-11, we're down relative to the March forecast by about $532 million. That signifies weaker withholding in the near term than we had anticipated. Not dramatically, but withholding's a large enough component that you add up a lot of dollars very quickly. With very small changes. And then again, a slower recovery in 2011. So here's your general fund resources picture for the current biennium. As I mentioned, the ending balance of negative 351.3. The net available resources from the close of session forecast back at this time in 2007 is down about $1.3 billion. And what I would point out about that is nearly all of that occurred in the last 9 months. That is the magnitude of variability that we're seeing in the current tax structure. Just sort of a longer-term look, I think the point here is simply that our long-term outlook hasn't changed dramatically from March. If we look way down the line, it's worse, but it's not the magnitude that we've seen in the past. So as we look just at personal income taxes, the projected decrease for fiscal year 09 right now is about 15.3%. Again, that compares to 11.1% in 2002. If we're just trying to provide some context as to what we're seeing now versus what previously was recognized as sort of the worst revenue downturn in the state. And a little comment about the timing of how all this has occurred. What we're finding when we look at returns and information from the Department of Revenue that they provide us just very recently, and we knew this to some extent, but not to the extent that we're finding out now, people, and through no fault of their own, people vastly overpaid estimated taxes in 2008. And that makes... You know, it makes sense conceptually. But what that does is, from a fiscal year to fiscal year perspective, it effectively moves money into fiscal year 08 because the first two payments for 08 were actually in the last fiscal year. It makes fiscal year 08 look better and fiscal year 09 look worse. And so it has that effect, and that's what we're seeing play out right now. Again, the decrease for 09-11 is about $407 million, and we'll talk a little bit more about that in a second. Last time I was here and last time we talked a lot about just sort of the growing variability of our tax structure, absent any forecasts, absent anything else. This is another representation of this occurring. What this shows is sort of the gross transaction dollars that occur during the reconciliation period every April. So as a percentage of all transactions that occur. So if there's more in April than in the April reconciliation period than in, say, withholding and estimated payments, what that does is as we go through the year, it increases uncertainty when we get to that point because that's where a higher concentration of our tax dollar transactions occur. And you can see that over the past 10 years or so, that has gone up by about a third. And so last time we talked about higher income inequalities, a smaller number of taxpayers dictating a larger proportion of our tax base, that sort of thing. This is another representation of that. Is that through the reconciliation period at the end of every fiscal year, we're seeing more and more variability tied to the end. Briefly on corporate income taxes and other general fund revenue, corporate income taxes were decreased significantly. We also, something that came out of both discussions with the Governor's Council of Economic Advisors and the Revenue Advisory Committee, a separate committee made up of members of Legislative Revenue Office, the Department of Revenue, and tax accountants, tax lawyers. We increased the variability in the corporate income tax forecast. What that does is in a downturn, it makes it deeper, and in an upturn, makes it a little bit better. Unfortunately, we're in that downturn. So we did decrease it by 62.1. As I said, it was down 70% in the first quarter of this year, year over year, and by 117.4 for the 2009-11 biennium. I feel a bit like a broken record, but most other revenue was also revised downward, although in sheer magnitude numbers, much smaller than the previous numbers that we talked about. I just want to talk a little bit about sort of an interesting phenomenon that we've encountered with looking at biennial growth rates and as a way of sort of looking at reasonableness and just sort of, you know, the 10,000-foot view of what are we really looking at. This is not in your packet, I should say. I apologize for that. We did send it over to LRO late yesterday as we were wrapping up some things. So I apologize for that. But these are kicker adjusted, so these are sort of structural revenue growth periods. And if you look at this first chart, it looks like, you know, 2001-03 was maybe even a little bit deeper than what we're looking at right now. And I want you to remember that minus 6.2 number. What we talked about before and what I'll say again is that unlike 01-03, what we're seeing here is the recession straddling the biennia. So instead of it all happening in a 1, we're seeing it in a 2. So as an exercise to illustrate this, we switched and made a hypothetical biennia chart of even-numbered years, so 2000, 2002, 2002, 2004, and likewise, and see what it does. What it does is it smooths out the last recession over bienniums and makes the current one look dramatically worse. And so this is sort of just a representation of how, because 2 years is such a long period of time, the timing of when recessions come in relative to our revenue streams can make it very misleading as to sort of the overall growth rates that we have in there.
This is a great chart.
Really quick on the budgetary reserve outlook, this chart will be revised undoubtedly in the next month, but we felt the need to put it in. One thing I will say about it is the deposits for the Education Stability Fund, should you not spend any money out of that fund through sometime in the middle of fiscal year 2011, you will likely hit the cap for the amount of money that would be in there. Recognizing that we all recognize that may or may not actually occur, but it is current law, and so that's, and we have a current law forecast.
We appreciate the warning.
Very much.
Obvious risks to the forecast, I think as both Joe and Tom talked about, we do have increased variability and uncertainty in what we're looking at right now. To the extent that that we take a little bit longer, take a little bit shorter, when we look at sort of coming out of recessions, what does that look like from on a revenue stream? What we look at is it probably with a big, we always have, you know, 2-3 years of pretty healthy growth. And 1 year in particular that always looks significantly better than anything we've seen, sort of a rebasing back to certain types of income. And when we look at those scenarios, it really looks like that's going to be fiscal year 12 probably, which doesn't help you with the next biennium. The possibility does exist that it could be fiscal year 11, in which case the stock market comes back faster, in which case you'll see higher than expected receipts. And that just speaks, again, to the timing and nature of this rebound. As Tom said, we will recover. We may not, and as Joe said, we may not look like we did before. But when you lose about 2/3 of your capital gains income, as we have right now, in sheer dollar magnitude, you can't do that again. You've already lost 2/3 of it. So we'll bounce along the bottom for a little bit, but we will see some recovery. And we expect to see a lot of it in two components first, and those would be capital gains and business income. Business income is becoming a larger and larger proportion of in the income stream as well, and it's more variable than, say, wages. So, again, we're talking about increased variability, absent any forecast, absent anything else, just in terms of the structure. briefly, I'll touch on the lottery revenue forecast, as that is another component to your budgetary and revenue picture. Sales are off year-ago levels by up to 24% week over week for lottery. This is dominated by video lottery, as you know. We have very minimal changes. We built all of this in March. They came in slightly ahead of our forecast in the first quarter, but there really isn't a significant change to the lottery forecast at all. It's up a relatively minimal amount. The transfer rate for lottery will be increased on sales beginning in July. What that means is the almost $103 million we saw in administrative savings this year, or this biennium, will likely be smaller. And less sporadic, because what they'll do is they'll transfer more as they go and less on lump sums through administrative savings. With that, I think I imagine there are some questions for any and all of us. So I'll turn it back over to the chair.
Thank you very much. Let's take questions. Representative Bailey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Tom, and to everybody for your hard work on this. It's sobering news, to be sure, and it's clear that, like the rest of the nation, Oregon's economy is hurting, and like Oregonians, government is going to have to tighten its belt. And as we look at ways to protect education, public safety, health care, where are our levers? I'm struck by the photo that you have in your slideshow of the kayaker. Can we influence the river? Or are we simply navigating the rapids?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bailey, in some respects, we are just navigating the rapids. I mean, this thing is so international in scope. A state our size has a pretty tough job to actually maybe steer around that. So we're in it. What can we make the best of a bad situation? And, you know, from your perspective, we've just shown you that, for example, in this biennium, there's a $350 million deficit. And that equation is, you know, revenues that come in minus expenditures that go out equal the end result. And this time the expenditures are greater than the revenues. And so to change that equation, the two levers you have in a very broad and simplified way is the changing the revenue side and changing the expenditure side. Now, how best to do that is what you will be spending the next weeks debating. You've already tackled quite a bit on the expenditure side, and I'm sure you will do so again. I think it's very interesting, just as a comment, this isn't necessarily a recommendation, but I think it's been very interesting to see the use of furlough days in this recession relative to past recessions. And this is a common practice that happened before at businesses, especially manufacturing. They'd shut down for a couple weeks while they either retool or when during a slow period. But it's actually worked its way through the service sector, too. So I imagine that that's probably going to be a further use tool that is interesting from our part, too, because that means when recoveries happen, you can actually ramp up a lot faster if you already have the people around than if they're then you have a segment that's laid off.
Interesting.
Yes, Representative Bailey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm curious, as you describe the impact on the various revenue streams that we have, you mentioned a decline in revenues resulting from the personal income tax. Do you have a sense of the distribution of that decline across income streams?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bailey, once the data comes in, we will have a better idea of that when the Revenue Department has from their micro data and can tell. But if we're looking at past recessions, looking at now, you know, the capital gains income down two-thirds, and that does tend to be concentrated at the higher income area. So definitely at the higher income stream, that has been part of the aspect of the revenues coming down. And just the fact that, you know, the top is at about 10%, is close to 50% of the personal income tax revenues. Aspects that hit that group causes a great volatility in our tax revenues.
Thank you. Other questions? Yes, Representative Gelser.
Thanks, Representative Barnhart. In the 2007-09, on the slide that talks about our shortfall that still remains for this biennium, I assume that does not include the numbers we just heard the other day from the Department of Human Services and their need for a rebalance because of the increased demand on services due to the decline in the economy.
Representative Barnhart, Representative Gelser, that's absolutely right. This is only the projections that for the expenditure side as of you know, are from our March forecast. That didn't really change from that. So any of those prospective ones that could happen are not included in that. That's correct.
Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions?
Yes.
Senator Carter.
Tom, when we talked the last time, you made my heart break a little bit today because we thought maybe about the third quarter of 2010 we would see at least not as much volatility as we are seeing right now. But didn't I hear you stretch that to 2011?
Mr. Chair, Senator Carter, the aspect of a turnaround we think is going to start to happen at the second half of this year. I think more like probably the fall. Now, that means that, well, businesses' sales start to look a little better, orders are better, you know, but they're reluctant to hire anybody yet. They want to make sure this is truly a recovery. And they will still probably see some segments that are lagging, and some segments will do better. For example, commercial real estate, they're starting to really feel it bad now, and they'll probably still feel it bad as we get into the end of this year and into 2010. So what we're looking at is that the employment part starts to turn around in the second quarter of 2010, in that the drops don't become as dramatic. We have a small little job loss overall in the first quarter of 2010, and then we believe there'll be some positive job growth. But that job growth will start to occur, it will build, and will be stronger in 2011. Then we get to sort of a more robust growth of sort of the 2% range. But probably not till 2013 till we regain the same level of total employment that we had at the start of this recession.
Okay. So follow up, Mr. Chairman?
Yes, please.
Now, you gave a stark analogy in March where you were speaking, and either the three of you could pop in, please, that you felt that once we get into the belly of the whale, we'll wallow a little bit. Are you seeing anything that would change that picture, that we will still make gradual ascensions as opposed to wallowing down there a bit by December?
Mr. Chair, Senator Carter, I hate the analogy, but you're right. Wallowing, I think, is what we will see in this year. As I said, you know, we think the worst quarters were the fourth quarter and the first quarter of this year, and still some large drops in this quarter. And so we'll start to do somewhat better, but the job losses will be very small then as we start to get into 2010. So that'll be kind of a wallowing type period. And as I said, and then you're still at a fairly low job level, and then finally it's 2011 that you start to see some better growth.
Joe?
Yes, please.
I'm sorry. Go on, Joe.
Yeah, I think the council in broad terms agrees with Tom that the fourth quarter of last year, first quarter of this year were the free fall period, and that's, I think, coming to an end. And the question is, you know, what's the shape of the bottom? Is it flat or do we bounce some? And I think that's the really most difficult thing to predict at this point.
Well, since our receipts are down by 70%, Mr. Chairman, I'm sorry, did you tell
no,
me?
No, please go ahead.
Since our business receipts are down about 70%, you were saying on your record, and then if in the top brackets of the personal income tax that you're seeing a great loss, what can we expect in the middle? Will there be some kind of a trend upwards, or can we expect the top to start seeing job changes? Because when you look at Nike and other companies that are laying off, what kind of effect this is going to have on the state of Oregon?
I'm going to think about that while I let Josh answer.
Mr. Chair, Senator Carter, it's good to be king. There's a few scenarios that can play out, obviously, given that situation. Tom mentioned one aspect of it. Tom mentioned the dramatic increase in the use of furloughs. What that does relative to our tax structure is decrease withholding more now,
okay,
but allows for greater ramping up of withholding when things do start to look better. Instead of going out and having to hire somebody, you simply increase their hours worked. Because what's happening now is people are working fewer and fewer hours every week to avoid layoffs. And so to the extent that inventories are very low with businesses, and that businesses, when they start to see sales pick up, need to ramp up production, they can do it a lot faster than in previous recessions. So that's a scenario that we could see play out. The other is simply the nature of business income is very volatile because it's a net number of expenses and profits, and it moves in dramatic scope from one year to the next. So a relatively small change economically could and has driven both large decreases and large increases in business taxes.
Joe, do you have comments?
No, I think that's right.
Okay. Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Senator Burdick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Obviously, as we look at these numbers for both the current biennium and the next biennium, we are considering revenue options. So in terms of the recovery itself, could you give us a little analysis or guidance on how various revenue strategies would affect the recovery itself? You know, the basic categories are, you know, higher, some kind of increase for very high income people who make up a disproportionate percentage of our income stream, corporate taxes for profitable corporations, minimum taxes for corporations that don't show a profit, and a more broad-based, but obviously smaller percentage revenue package that might include all income groups. So among those four, can you give us some comments on how strategies focusing on each of those would affect the recovery itself, if at all?
Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick, let me start with a broad view. And the broad view here is that you're damned if you do, damned if you don't. You have to have a situation where government is not a, and the state level is not a stimulus. You're basically having to make policies that are contractionary in nature because you have to balance a budget, unlike the federal government. So when you raise taxes, the general statement overall is that that dampens a recovery. If you cut expenditures, that dampens a recovery. So you can't get around that. And that's the broad statement. But I think then it's, okay, which is the least dampening of the group of approach? And there's a great debate on those areas also. Now, you can have debates on the taxes to higher income individuals, say, you know, over $250,000 yearly household income. Some people will say that, well, those people will just merely decrease their savings a little bit and pay the taxes, and the taxes then get re-spent into the economy. And although there may be a little dampening effect because they are taxes, spending doesn't have to be cut as much. And so the dampening effect of cutting spending is not as bad as the rise in the taxes. Other people will say, well, this is a this is your entrepreneurial group. These are the movers and shakers. There are effects that if these people aren't be able to reap the economic benefits from their actions, they slow their actions down. And that can have a further negative effect on the economy. And the same statement with the minimum tax on corporations. And the corporations, too, you want to recognize there's aspects of sort of an efficiency, you know. If you tax them, do they raise their minimum tax? Does that change their behavior at all? And if it doesn't change their behavior at all, well, then you could raise the taxes. On the other hand, there's equity questions and fairness questions. Some firms that will actually, depending on their economic well-being at the moment, a rise in the minimum tax could actually be harmful to them. Where other businesses, it won't be. So so it's, you know, to give you a straight answer is really difficult. Paul Warner is much better at that, actually.
And you may be sure we'll ask him.
But I will say, I mean, we want to be involved in these discussions, and we work with Paul's office closely, and we, you know, hope to be involved in those kind of discussions and assist you in those areas.
Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick, just one comment relative to this, not judging any of the validity of any of these at all, but something to consider as you move forward, and that is to the extent that you're increasing taxes on higher volatility income sources, you will realize the upside gain, but you also in the future will realize a bigger downside loss. So as we talked about the volatility thing, to the extent that your high-income earners or business taxes in particular, those are generally very highly volatile income sources. So something to consider as you move.
Actually, Mr. Chair, that kind of leads to a follow-up, if I could. You know, one of the things that people around here are talking about is here we are in this trough and in uncharted territory, which I think we all recognize we're in. And so we're already concerned that we might be, you know, still squirming around the bottom and actually get a kicker if we, you know, come out of this recession in a way that we didn't predict. Given the nature of the likely recovery in terms of volatility, how, if you had to predict the likelihood of a kicker, what would you say?
Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick, I think the way that we have to approach these things and the way that we do is that we're providing a point estimate in the middle. We feel like right at this moment that our forecast for revenues for the 2009-11 biennium are, it's just as likely that they'll come in higher as lower. So to answer your question, to the extent that we can go a little bit higher and not have a kicker, it's a little less than 50%.
Okay, thank you. Representative Bruin.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Burdick's question was exactly my question, but I would, Tom, I'd try to drill down just a little bit more on the revenue side. Just given your experience, both in the building and studying it, the economic history of this, how has this? I mean, the state had this example in the early 80s with our temporary income tax surcharge. Given that history and given the hindsight, what can you give us an indication of the success or failure, or is it truly that damned if you do, damned if you don't? It was pro and con of each, of looking at specific tax increase measures, and I think what we're most concerned about, or at least looking at, are the personal income taxes and the business taxes.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bruin.
I guess the question is, has it worked or has it not worked? Historically.
I think what you come down to is basically a decision on redistribution of income. And what I mean by that is states take a look, we did in the early 80s, and saying, what services do we have to cut out? And who are the people affected by that? And even though because the debates are about a dampening effect on recovery and so on, there was a move more towards the, you know, saving some of these services in spite of the fact that possibly raising these taxes could be a dampening effect. So I think in terms of if it works, if that is your goal, I think it works. If the goal is purely the economics and how the recovery may be hurt or helped, that's a debatable question.
Well, can I a quick follow-up to that?
Please. Yeah.
Our most recent example is the last recession we had, the 02, 01, 02, 03, that time frame. And, of course, this body put out a tax, a pretty dramatic tax increase proposal that was rejected by the voters in Measure 30. So can we go back and look at that example, fairly recent history, and say that was the right decision or the wrong decision? And I'm not trying to be subjective about it. I'm trying to say, would we have done more harm had that passed? We got through it without by turning down Measure 30. Can you give any analysis on that as we're looking at some of the same things this biennium?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bruin, you know, that sort of thought experiment. You know, if it had gone through and would have hurt or helped, I really think you'd probably be at the same point you were at today.
Okay.
Whether those taxes had passed or not. Once again, the effect on people would be different. What group of people? less to the higher income and greater services to lower income people. But I think overall, with a temporary change like that, it affects some timing and so on. But I think for a state like us and the degree to the strength of the overall U.S. economy, international conditions, we would have probably ended up the same.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Berger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to flip over to the other side of this discussion, which is unemployment, which is our problem. When we're dependent on income taxes and we don't have income, we have this unemployment. Michigan's our only competitor in these numbers. We know their car troubles. I always go out and talk to people and they say, why are we so bad? And why are we so bad? And really what I'm trying to get at is, what are we not, this is round two for a lot of people in this room on this, and what didn't we do structurally? What should we be doing structurally so we aren't in this heavy competition with Michigan over a dive to the bottom on the unemployment numbers? Because that in the end is what this is all about. If people are working, the state can support these services. If people aren't working, we simply can't.
Mr. Chair and Representative Berger, there are some similarities between Oregon and Michigan, and the key one is our dependence on durable goods manufacturing, the fact that we both make long-lived capital goods. They make cars, we make timber, wood products, we make transportation equipment, trucks, barges, recreational vehicles, or we used to anyhow, electronics, and a variety of other long-lived things that when there's a recession, businesses and consumers can put off their purchases of those things. So best is, and Tom may have a slightly different number, but my calculation would suggest we're about one-third more dependent on durable goods manufacturing than the rest of the country. And you saw that in the export numbers that Tom gave you. I mean, exports are physical goods that get shipped overseas. Most of them are durables. So there's just more volatility in our economy. And the other thing is this labor market factor, that we've got more people looking for work in Oregon, and it's a product of a couple of things. One of it's this what we call added worker, that people go looking for work when times are bad here. We also know that we have substantial in-migration, that people are moving to Oregon without jobs and aren't leaving even when they lose their jobs. If our labor market looked like North Dakota's, we would have substantially lower unemployment rates because people don't stick around if there aren't jobs. So as long as we have an economy that's based significantly on durable goods and have a desirable place to live, which we do, then we're going to have, in recessions like this one, higher unemployment rates than the rest of the country.
So the structural thing, don't depend on durable goods. What are you pointing to in terms of how we as policymakers should be looking at this? Because I don't want to be around for round three as bad as round one and round two have been.
And if the Oregon economy were like your stock portfolio, you could pick up the phone and call your broker and say, I want to sell off all my durable goods stuff and get into non-durable goods that are less volatile. Mm-hmm. Economies don't work that way. And we have to essentially, I think, play the hand we're dealt. And given the structure of our economy with its reliance on durable goods and the structure of our tax system, which depends heavily, as you heard, on capital gains and on business income in particular, which are more volatile, we have to have a budgeting system, and the rainy day funds and reserve funds come in here, that enable us to cope with the inherent volatility in our economy and our revenue system. I don't think you can't redesign your economy or change your economy to offset that entirely.
Yes, please.
One follow-up, Mr. Chair, and then I'll pass the baton. But what I'm hearing in there implicit is sort of a Tom McCall message, please don't come here, there aren't any jobs, or because you're adding to our problems.
Well, I wouldn't put it quite that way. I think in the long run, our ability to attract really talented people helps fuel our economy. The critical ingredient to success in the economy of the 21st century is having lots of smart people. You obviously want to educate your own population. You want your employers to be able to get the best people around the world. So in the long run, that is a very good thing. In the short term, it has the effect of pushing up our unemployment rate. And I wouldn't trade places with a North Dakota, for example, that isn't an attractive place, doesn't attract talented people, but right now has a much lower unemployment rate than we do. So I think you just have to look at that unemployment rate and realize that that's going to be somewhat higher in Oregon, just by virtue of our attractiveness.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Call.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to dig down, following up on Senator Burdick's questioning, I'd like to dig down on the expenditure side of the ledger to try to get at the impact on the economy from that angle. If we're talking about a 15, at worst case scenario, 15% cut, that could mean about 4,000 laid off state employees. What does that do to our unemployment numbers? What does that do to our economy? How does that affect, this recession? And is that scenario taken into account in the economic forecast that you've put in front of us?
Mr. Chair, Representative Call, to the degree that we know that the state is going to have probably more layoffs, we did not factor in specifically a 15% drop. But in the forecast in there is an aspect that as we're going forward here, state government and local governments are going to be losing employment. State and local governments tend to be tend to lag the recessions that happen. I mean, you have to get together. You've got to make the decisions. And as we've seen this past time, too, the tax revenues were a little later to fall than opposed to states that were mostly dependent on sales taxes. And so we're lagging this aspect. And also it tends to be longer drawn out. Tends not to be as deep as, let's say, a company that has to cut 1,000 employees for a period of time, but the cuts tend to be longer and the non-hiring tends to stay longer. So that kind of scenario is in our forecast and in these numbers.
Great. Mr. Chair, can I have a follow-up?
Yes, please.
And I'd like to look at the taxation side of the ledger just briefly. The other side of the equation, and just talk about what tools are out there. And one of the things I've been having great difficulty with is trying to find a historical precedent for what we're doing now and looking at some of the things that we could be doing now that were done in past times. And, you know, I'm having a hard time finding a historical corollary. You know, some of the big things that were done in the 80s, the repeal of the unitary tax, the movement towards, you know, the diversification and the internationalization of our economy, and in an era where we weren't as general fund dependent as we are now for so much of what we're doing. And so even hearkening back to the 80s seems to me not an adequate comparison to what we're doing now. And so I guess my question is, what are the tools that are out there for us on that side of the ledger? Do we have the same tools? Are there newer tools? Have we become more sophisticated in our utilization of the tax code such that while we may not be able to do some of the broader things and we may be more general fund dependent than we were, you know, we've become more sophisticated in dealing with these situations such that there is a way forward through the tax code to try to, you know, not only raise revenue but spur development?
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Call, I'm not of the opinion that our tax code has had a huge impact on the pattern of development in our economy. And I think the other thing I would add is I think it's important if you're thinking about strategy and repositioning the Oregon economy that you don't look backwards but instead look forwards and say, what is it that it takes for a place to be successful and prosperous in what is increasingly a global and knowledge-based economy. And so I'd start with that as my perspective and then say, what are the critical ingredients that we in Oregon have to invest in to be successful? And I think there are just a couple of things that, you know, as many of you know, I work with the Oregon Business Council on the Oregon Business Plan, and that's, you know, a big part of the discussion there is thinking about the state's future. And two of the critical things are, first of all, education. And again, the single biggest factor in shaping the prosperity of places in this global economy is how well-educated, how highly skilled their populations are. So the investments that you make in that, particularly in the long run, are critical. And then the second thing is to know what you're really good at, where you have a defensible competitive advantage in the global economy, like in power generation. But in our case, you know, I think historically there have been industries that we're very good at and continue to be good at, and I think we need to look to what are the new industries and the new kinds of knowledge that we can build on. So I think the sustainable industries are really important ones for us to be thinking about going into the future. And your tax policy, I think, can help support those in some ways, but it's really about thinking about, you know, what's the human capital, what's the knowledge assets that you've got in place.
Finished. Representative Reed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Berger asked the question I was interested in, so I'll pass.
Oh, she did. Sorry. Representative Vance.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just curious about your initial remarks regarding the increased level of uncertainty, and I'm just wondering how that plays out and what we're looking at here as compared to, let's say, 6 months ago, which seemed to be pretty uncertain then. Have times become less uncertain? Are they more uncertain? And then put a number on it, if you could. How much weight should we truly give this forecast? Is it, or maybe how much less weight should we give it, given the level of uncertainty you mentioned at the onset of the report?
Well, yeah, that's the difficult question, is to say how broad that what we call the confidence interval is around that forecast. Again, our feeling, I think, and I speak for myself, and I think I fairly reflect the Governor's Council, that if you have to pick one number that we think is our best guess of where we'll end up as our economy over the next 2 years, that's a good number. But the band of uncertainty around what that performance will actually be is pretty high. I mean, it could be, you know, I don't know, 5 or 10% higher, 5 or 10% lower, in terms of total economic activity, depending on whether this is that L-shaped recovery or whether we get a fairly rapid recovery. And, you know, to the issue that I think is important from a revenue standpoint, you know, the likelihood that we're going to hit it within 2%, which is the kicker threshold, I think is pretty low. So.
Representative Vance.
I'm just interested, I guess, in knowing whether today is a safer economic environment than it was 6 months ago, or are we just fooling ourselves and thinking that we've reached the bottom and that things maybe aren't getting better, they just appear to be today?
Well, again, and you heard a couple of examples of this, you know, that once you've lost two-thirds of your capital gains, it's unlikely that you'll lose that same dollar amount. It's actually statistically not possible to lose that same dollar amount of capital gains going forward. And I think the kind of free fall that we've seen in the economy from about September of 2008 through last month is slowing. So there are some reasons for optimism. But by the same token, you know, we know that financial markets have still not reverted to sort of more normal conditions. We've still got a lot of issues to work through, and that's not just uncertainty, that's risk. Risk in the sense that we don't know what the distribution of possible outcomes is. So, you know, that's, again, when you interpret these numbers, you know, there is possibilities, there are scenarios both for it to be worse and then also for this unprecedented fiscal medicine to kick in and stimulate the economy and rebound fairly quickly. And it's very, very difficult to forecast.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The answer that Tom gave to Representative Bruin and the answer that Joe gave to Representative Call, I want to make sure I understood both of those answers. What I heard Tom say was that it made little or no difference to our current position and as to the economy whether those taxes had gone into effect or not, and the only real effect was the effect on people, that is, an inability to provide services. And then what I heard Joe say to Representative Call was that most important factor in our economic long term was education, and I want to know how those two things fit together.
Mr. Chair, Representative Riley, first, any tax increase that happens has to be seen in terms of the magnitude of that tax change. If you raise taxes by a tremendous amount, where, say, top income groups are being taxed, rather than moving them towards a 10%, but you move them towards a 50%, that's a much different story.
Absolutely.
Of what the impact would be. So in my statement there would be a relatively minor increase. Mm-hmm. In terms of the taxes, in terms of I don't think that would have much of an impact on the economy. And then I don't know if you want to talk about the education.
Yeah, I just make the distinction between the short term and the economic cycle we're going through in the long term. Mm-hmm. In the short term, there is very little the state can do to influence it. As Tom pointed out, this is not just a national, this is a global crisis. So you're adjusting fiscal policy one way or another is going to have very little impact on the shape of that recovery. It will be determined by global and national events. Now, if you're talking about the long term, I think the state of Oregon has a lot to do. The investments and policies that you put in place will have long-term effects in terms of the shape of our future economic development. So that's the distinction that I'd make.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Senator Morris.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my comments are my point is probably more by way of comment, and I would certainly elicit your response than it is a question. There are three threads here. One is the statement that we need to manage the hand that's dealt us, and that's pretty clear. We do have an economy. It is what it is. The high dependence on durable goods. The statement that, and it's very obvious, there's a lot of uncertainty, and that uncertainty drives volatility, or the volatility in our economy drives the uncertainty, one or the other. But in the end result, we wind up with volatility in our taxes. So they're very, very difficult to to forecast. The third is stability. And there is no one in this building that doesn't value stability for those critical services. But when you add all of these things up, in light of the fiscal policies that we have in this state, particularly with respect to the kicker, changing the tax code is very difficult. Changing the kicker is probably less difficult, but it's still difficult. And it just this is kind of a rhetorical question, observation. What in the world does it take in this state to turn the light on and say, folks, we need to change the way we're doing things? We need to manage the hand that's dealt us and provide stability for our state. And if we're not at the bottom of the barrel and the light hasn't come on, I don't know what it takes to get the light to come on to convince us that we have to build stability. And the only way we can do that is through some type of a reserve fund and a way to fund it. It's more of a comment than it is a question, but it troubles me deeply. We just continue to do what we're doing and expect different results, and that is insanity by some people's definition.
Mr. Chair, Senator Morse, in our office, when we work on the forecast, we try our best to not think about the kicker. And what I mean by that is that we've got to give you the best sort of unbiased view of where we think things are going. Even though we recognize, just as Josh was telling you, the timing of a recovery, it could be that it mostly hits in fiscal year 12, but it could be mostly hitting in fiscal year 11, which, when all is said and done at the very end of 09-11, it could easily bump above 2%, and you would have a kicker. I think that given what you've just said is absolutely true, the volatility of our tax system, because our economy also, as Joe has mentioned, a durable goods-based manufacturing, you've got a volatility there accentuating another volatile source of income, taxes. So, yes, a reserve fund does go to your third point of providing greater stability, because you would be able to sort of smooth out the mountains and the valleys.
Senator Telfer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Tom, you said that using conventional approaches to addressing the shortfall in the short term are damned if we do, damned if we don't, whereby increasing taxes has a dampening effect along with reducing services, cutting costs, would also have a dampening effect. Would we be drawing some of that dampening effect out if, in fact, we found resources that were not increases in taxes that could, in fact, address the cost levels of the state, whereby we could, in fact, address the increased need to provide services to Oregonians in this economic time. So I guess my point is, if in fact we found other resources that we could use that were not requiring increasing taxes, that would enable us to not cut services to Oregonians, would that have still have a dampening effect in the short term?
Mr. Chair, Senator Telfer, any resource that is found that doesn't include increasing taxes that allows you to continue spending would not be a dampening effect. I just don't know where those resources would be.
I have a couple of questions. First, I'd like to go back to the numbers, if we could, for a moment. I noticed that on slide 16, at least that's the number on my page here, you have an ending fund balance of minus $351 million for 07-09, for the biennium we're in now. On the next page, you show net available resources down from the March forecast of 260.6. There's a difference of $90 million. Can you explain what that difference is?
Absolutely, Mr. Chairman. This incorporates, as I said, current law. And after the March forecast, there was a deficit of about $855 million. You close that gap by both decreasing expenditures and increasing some revenue through fund sweeps, and the general fund receives some revenue of net dollars from liquor and criminal fines and assessments. So what that revenue did was increased general fund revenue by roughly $90 million, and that's why you see a difference. If you notice, the difference is all in the other revenues category, the third one down, and that's one-time transfers that occurred. So because Senate Bill 581, I believe it was, passed, you sort of netted out a portion of the 350 that went down. It was a point of confusion in our office with other people, so I recognize that it is confusing. But what ended up happening is that in order to close the gap from the March forecast, one of the ways you did it was increase the revenues. If you just cut $855 million from expenditures, mm-hmm. your ending balance would be the same, and it would match the decrease in the revenue forecast.
All right.
Now, that didn't help.
No, it doesn't. It doesn't help at all, because when I think of the ending balance, what I think of is the difference between revenue and expenditures. I think you've just told us that revenues went up, and therefore we have an increase in the negative side on the ending fund balance. And I don't understand that.
You're right with the first point, Mr. Chair. Let's see if I can do this differently. After the March forecast, you got to the point where you closed an $855 million gap to roughly zero. Okay? But you didn't simply cut expenditures by $855 million. You only cut them by $760 million, roughly. $765. But you increased revenue through fund sweeps and those kinds of things. That's in the other revenue category. But you got an ending balance to roughly zero. So absent any changes in the forecast, you would have seen an increase in resources of about $90 million. And so then we decreased the forecast by about $350 million. Instead of being up 90, you're down 260 from a resource perspective. But because you haven't cut all of the expenditures to get rid of the previous balance, you actually go further negative down to 350. The ending balance is representative of a change in general fund forecast, absent the revenue increases you did to close the gap from March.
Thank you. No, I do understand. Now, I think what you said is that based on your numbers, we went up $90 million after March with the various changes we made, right. And now that we're back down. But we only zeroed out the overall numbers.
Right.
And therefore, when you drop an extra 260, we're actually down 351. I think that's what you've just said. And just to make it really simple for me, I think what you're saying is, in order to get to a zero ending fund balance, we have to find $351 million either through cuts revenue increases or use of reserves?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. That is helpful. I also wanted to go back and talk about this long-term, short-term thing. There have been a number of questions from both committees and from our co-chair, who's here, or of the Ways and Means Committee, about a variety of issues involving the effect of our actions on the state economy. And I wanted to summarize it and then find out whether I've got it right, whether I've missed it, what your thoughts are, of what your answers are. And I think if I can summarize, your answers basically are that barring some enormous tax increase, I think you used the term 50%, barring some enormous tax increase, the state action has little or no effect on the shape of the immediate economy, that things are going to happen the way they do because there are many larger forces in the world and in our own economy locally than the ones that the state acts upon. Small changes, and I think you mentioned 10% at the top end, for example, have very little or no effect on the short term. But I think you also said that the state's long-term policies, what it spends money on, what kinds of things it supports, can have a profound effect on the long-term economy because, and I think you said this, the education and the ability of the state to attract educated workers, either because we import them or because we raise them locally, hopefully both, can have a profound effect on the positive side of the state economy. You didn't say the next thing, but I think you probably mean this too. On the other hand, if we don't do those things, we can expect our long-term economy to grow less quickly, to be less robust, to be less resistant to future economic shocks and the like. Now, respond to those ideas and tell me if I've gotten it or not.
Mr. Chairman, that's a good synthesis of the way I would put it, and I would hasten to add that I'm not sure everybody on the Governor's Council of Economic Advisors would necessarily agree with that, but that does reflect my view.
Thank you.
And Mr. Chair, you know, a small rise in tax rates, you know, you were essentially the top end is essentially at 9%. But if you raise that up a little bit, in the short term, I don't think that has much of an impact on the economic recovery or the economy overall. But just as Joe mentioned, our other members of the Governor's Council of Economic Advisors would maybe take a little longer view of that and say, well, your top-end people can vote with their feet. And if they believe that this is the tip of an iceberg and this is going to be, you know, further rises are going to happen, then you may see possibly these people moving out of the state.
Thank you. Senator Hass and then Representative Broom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On that train of thought, as you know, there's discussion about a provider tax, which would have the effect of matching roughly $1 billion in federal money, and I'm just wondering if you could comment on the stimulus effect that money would have. Is that enough to be measured in your forecasts henceforth or not?
You're going to let me answer this one, aren't you? Mr. Chair, Senator Haas, we've not explicitly taken that into account, and I would, at the moment, rather than venture an opinion, I'd want to be in a locked room with Paul and talk about it first.
Thank you. Representative Broom.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to sort of try to put a period at the end of the point that you were making, and I think that all three of the witnesses suggested, which is from a taxing perspective, it's a short, and Josh, I think your direct quote, and I want to see if Joe and Tom agree with this, was short-term gain, but then you went on to say long-term, if I heard you correctly, long-term pain, or maybe that was my thinking where you're going with it. And all three of you mentioned the short-term gain. Tom, you mentioned that people can vote with their feet. Is that a general concurrence, though, among the three of you that, and I've heard you all say short-term is okay, but long-term, it's problematic?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bruin, just to clarify, you're generally correct of what I said. I think the point that I was trying to make is simply that to the extent that where you raise revenue now, the components, where you do it, to the extent that those things are more volatile, you will also see a greater downside risk going forward. So you'll realize the gain in the near term, but when the economy dips again, 6, 7, 10, 15 years from now, you will see a larger decrease.
Then, Mr. Chair, can I ask the question, and maybe you don't want to be, any of you want to be put on the spot for this, but if we're looking at something in the short term, does it make economic sense to have it be short term only? Does it make economic sense to whatever we're going to do, if we're going to do something on the revenue policy change side, to have it be a temporary rather than a permanent? From a future growth employment perspective.
No, Mr. Chair, Representative Bruin. Yes, I think the temporariness of it is less disruptive to your economy than if it was seen as a permanent change. Then that allows then people to then make decisions and say, well, rather than a short-term drop, say, in my post-tax income, this is a permanent thing, I should start looking for someplace else.
Mm-hmm.
So I really do think the temporary aspect is there. You know, and it's the same thing, just as, you know, in boom times, states should be putting money away. So that in the bad times, you know, and you don't put money away always, you know, when it rains, that's when you use the money. So I think the same thing here applies to, if you would have a temporary tax change.
Representative Bailey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you tell us, how does Oregon's income tax structure compare to other states? Is our relative tax on the high end of incomes higher or lower than average across the United States?
I'll let you finish up. I'll just quickly say, for us, because we hit our top marginal rate very, very quickly in, as we go up in incomes, for a large part of the population, it's almost like a proportional tax rather than progressive as we go up the income areas. Vermont comes to mind, has a little bit more of a graduated scale, and they're probably one of the more progressive tax areas. But unique to us, and there's only five states in the U.S. that do not have a sales tax. And that tends to be quite a bit of a proportional aspect. Actually more regressive, because regressivity is related to what portion of your income is the tax. Even though a sales tax is consumption, what is the dollar taxes you pay in sales relative to income? And thus a sales tax is always seen as somewhat regressive, because higher income people don't. So for us, I think we're sort of proportional. Most states, I'd say, are probably a little bit more on the somewhat regressive to proportional. And then just a few states are more progressive than what we are.
Well, Mr.
Yes, please.
And how does Oregon compare to its immediate neighbors, to Washington, for example?
We couldn't be more different, Mr. Chair, Representative Bailey. Washington has a very broad definition of sales tax. They have the business and operating taxes. They got a regular sales tax. There are real estate transaction taxes, where we have a much broader definition, of course, for the income tax. Although we also have a number of excise taxes, user-type taxes that we levy. To California, they have a large sales tax along with an income tax. Their tax structure, their tax revenues actually are much more volatile than ours because they have a much higher capital gains base than what we do. And Josh, you...
I I would just say one thing, I guess, Mr. Chair and Representative Bailey. As a percentage of your revenues, personal income taxes in Oregon, Oregon is the most dependent among states for personal income taxes as a percentage of their total revenue picture.
Mr.
Please.
So given that, for example, Oregon and Washington's tax structures are very different, and that we have high-income earners here who have chosen to live in a place where their income is taxed versus a place right across the river that has a difference of about 9%, it appears that something else is keeping them here in Oregon. And is the marginal difference between that 0% and, say, 9% greater or less than that marginal difference between, say, 9% and 10% and 11%? On the margin, will people vote with their feet, or have they already voted, in a sense?
Well, that's in part that's an empirical question too. I mean, but I think the gist of your argument is essentially right, that taxes are just one of many considerations that enter into people's decisions about where they're going to live and work, and another piece of it is the bundle of services and the kind of community that they have the opportunity to live in. You know, that said, you know, 10, 11, 12%, there are going to be some people who at the margin might make a different choice. And I think to Representative Bruin's point about the temporary nature of a tax change, if you can credibly, and I would emphasize the word credibly, communicate that the change is temporary, the effects are likely to be pretty minimal.
Well, Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Bailey.
Apologize for the length of this line of questioning.
No, it's fine. Go ahead.
Focusing in on that temporary versus permanent, use the word credibility, given that in the past we have examined at several points throughout our state's history temporary or permanent changes to the top end. Are we able to credibly make that statement in a way that does affect that decision making? And as a second point to that, if the permanent rate increases those other factors that keep people here, regardless of what that tax rate is, does that mitigate the impact of the temporary versus permanent choice?
That's a judgment call. You know, I don't think we have the definitive economic evidence to tell you whether you're credible enough and what those impacts are on those relatively few households that might be tempted to move one way or the other. You've got to make a judgment based on the way you see that one, because I don't think there's a definitive answer to it.
Thank you. 2 years ago, we had two economists who came to speak to the Revenue Committee, the House Revenue Committee, one of whom was thought of as a liberal and the other whom was thought of as a conservative. And we thought there was going to be a duel between economists about the economy and what the effects of taxation and all of that was going to be. And the interesting thing was that they ended up agreeing, essentially, on the idea that low tax, high tax isn't the issue. What is the issue is how effectively and efficiently you spend the money and what you spend it on. Does that make sense? What I've heard in the last few exchanges is a discussion about a piece of the equation. I'm really interested in the whole thing because any long-term effects we do have on the economy, we'd better make sure they're positive ones.
Mr. Chairman, you know, most of the states in the United States, state and local governments in the United States, spend between 9 and 11% of total personal income. They raise it in the form of various forms of taxes, and they spend it on state and local public services. They all do it in different ways. Oregon and Washington are very different. And I think your key point is right. There isn't a huge amount of variation there, and it's really the efficiency with which governments provide those services. And then, some tax systems will have some sharp edges for relatively few people. But it's the bigger issue of what package of services you provide that is really important in the long run in shaping the direction of your economy.
Thank you very much. Thank you, gentlemen, very much for your presentations today. We appreciate it. We're not pleased, of course, with the news that you bring us,
but it's important that we know about it as we do our planning over the next few weeks to try to make plans for Oregon's next biennium. Thank you very much. And with that, the House Committee on Revenue is adjourned.
And the Senate Finance and Revenue Committee is adjourned. Thank you very much.